Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for March's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, veterinary specialist in the Small Animal Clinic, Vet Swiss Faculty of Bern, Switzerland, Bianca Hetlick. Thank you, Bianca. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Ema, and welcome everyone to this afternoon's or early afternoon's webinar. We will talk on osteochondrosis in a variety of joints. Obviously focusing on the dog since the dog is the prime suspect when it comes to OCD. I will go through a little bit of the development of OCD, how we have identified the etiology and what we think is the cause or are the causes, and then go through the disease joint by joint, particularly for you guys in practice, you know, what steps would you take diagnostically? And what steps can you take for therapy, what makes sense in terms of arthroscopy or arthrotomy, and what are the prognoses most importantly. So the ossification, if we think of our embryo development, when puppies and kittens are born, their skeleton is still largely cartilaginous. And we have several mechanisms by which we will then ossify our bones. One is the intramembranous ossification, and there we have bone that develops directly from membranes, so to speak. And the classic example are the bones of the skull. So any flat bone is typically ossified by intramembranous ossification. And then we have the chondral ossification, and that is what is very important for us when we talk about OCD. There we first have our cartilaginous skeleton, and then we get ossification of this cartilage. And we have ossification in two areas. One is the endochondral ossification, and one is the perichondral ossification. I'm quite visual, and maybe an image helps you as well. When we look at this illustration, and we focus particularly on the images on the right, we see the perichondral ossification, these yellow lines that start forming bone along the diaphysis. And then the endochondral ossification are the typical areas in the epiphysis where we have a separation of our growing bone by the growth plates. And in this process here is the endochondral ossification. So peri and endochondral ossification, those are the two mechanisms of chondral ossification. We will focus particularly on the endochondral because this is the process in which we have difficulties and challenges and problems that then lead to the development of osteochondrosis or osteochondrosis dissecans. And here we have two potential areas that can have issues. One is the area of cartilage that then is at the very end of the bone, so the epiphyseal cartilage that is part of a joint. And we can also have a problem in the physeal cartilage, so in our growth plate itself. And the problems in the epiphyseal cartilage then typically lead to OCD development, and problems in the physeal cartilage typically lead to, if it develops, a retained cartilage core. So osteochondrosis in general is because of this happening in growing and ossifying cartilage, a problem of young animals. You will not develop osteochondrosis as a new disease once you're an adult. You can have existing problems that then clinically manifest, and that can certainly happen, but a true OCD will develop in very, very young growing animals and then typically also develop clinical signs at that age. So keep that in mind for differential diagnoses, that when you have an adult large breed dog and that adult dog has shoulder pain, unless that shoulder pain has been present since puppyhood, it's probably not an osteochondrosis of the shoulder. So when we when we talk about retained cartilage cores, like I said, this would be a problem of endochondral ossification of the physis. And in this image here, you can see the distal endobrachium radiographed. We have the radius on the right side and the ulna on the left side. And you can see outlined by these small black arrows, this flame-like appearance in the distal ulna growth plate. We can see these radiodense lines going proximally. And this entire plug here on the inside, that would be a cartilaginous core that has failed to ossify. And it is quite typical for this to be surrounded by sclerosis. The bone will sort of separate from this cartilage core. Clinically, we can have a variety of symptoms. Some dogs don't have any signs. They can live with this retained core quite happily. And as long as it doesn't affect their length growth, you may never know unless you take a radiograph for other reasons that there is a retained core. We can also see it that this core will influence the growth of that physis, and especially for the radius and ulna as being partner bones and being quite depending on an equal growth of both bones, then you can imagine if the core inhibits growth of the distal ulna physis, then we can have angular limb deforms develop, angular limb deformities develop. And you can see this on the image that is displayed here. There's also a large cartilaginous core here, not quite so flame-like like the other example. And we can see that this has led to a very severe distal bowing of the radius into the typical radius curvus that then gives these dogs this kind of seal-like appearance. When they walk around, they have quite a bow to the distal radius, and very, very often they also get quite a severe carpal valgus. It is very rare for these cores to lead to instability and then lead to a secondary fracture. That would be under the pathologic fractures simply because it is not due to trauma. So very, very rare. Like I said, some dogs are quite lucky. We have it as an incidental finding, or we may never know that it's there. Most dogs, in my experience, they will display some form of angular limb deformity. It may not be severe. And then you can, you know, you do your imaging and then you find that they have this retained core and very rarely the fracture. And then based on your clinical signs, either no treatment is required or you would try to have a correction of the deformity. But now we come to osteochondrosis dissecans. So you probably remember that we have, with OCD, we have this flap of cartilage that has failed to ossify. So in the development of, in this endochondral ossification where this cartilaginous skeleton has to be replaced by bone, we have a failure of this bone to replace cartilage. And we have one area that remains thicker. And this area that is thicker, that is then called an osteochondrosis. When, because of mechanical factors, you know, once a puppy starts moving around and we have friction in the joint, when this thicker area separates, then we talk of an osteochondrosis dissecans. So there are two stages of the same disease. The OC is the early stage where the thicker cartilage is in situ, and then once it fragments and we have a break off of the cartilage, then we call it an OCD. It was only relatively recently that researchers have found out that cartilage does have blood supply. I was still taught that cartilage is avascular, and that is certainly true in the mature cartilage, but in the growing cartilage, so in exactly these scenarios where we have newborn puppies that for several months have to undergo this endochondral ossification, they found that cartilage does indeed have a very, very fine network of capillary blood supply. And you can see this really, really nicely on this image on the left. And this was really quite a change in perception of how we saw OCD, and it helped us understand the development so much better, because before we really couldn't really tell why this would happen. So the number one hypothesis how OCD develops or how OC develops is if we follow the images on the right from top to bottom, we have the very, very young situation where we have subchondral bone starting to develop, and we still have quite a thick layer of cartilage, including the articular cartilage. And so some of this cartilage has to be replaced up to a certain depth, and this occurs. And so as the puppy grows, we get more bone developing, so we get a thinner and thinner layer of cartilage. Then through an area of ischemia, and this area is kind of dotted lined right here. We have one area that has a lack of blood supply or poor blood supply. And this part of the cartilage then fails to be transformed into bone. If there is no blood supply, usually the body can't do much, right? I mean, it can't heal fractures properly, it can't heal wounds properly. And in this case, because we have this focal area of ischemia, the subchondral bone and this endochondral ossification is not able to replace this particular bit of cartilage with subchondral bone. And at first, that's not a problem. It's just an area of thickening, so like we see here. And then the puppy gets older and starts romping around, playing around, jumping, and being a happy puppy. And this cartilage that is thicker has now a little bit of a harder time withstanding all these forces. Cartilage receives nutrition through diffusion. So it's very important for the joint to be mobile and for nutrition from the synovial fluid then to penetrate through the cartilage. But in areas where the cartilage is pathologically so much thicker, this diffusion cannot reach the deeper layers. So now we have cartilage cells that may die. They're certainly not happy. They often will separate from the underlying bone in this part. And then in addition with these now very active puppies, we can have it occur that these thicker areas then crack off. And this is displayed in the bottom image. So from an OC, so an osteochondrosis in the middle images to at the very bottom, now an osteochondrosis dissecans. So we start off with ischemia in the cartilage that needs to be replaced by endochondral ossification, and then this endochondral ossification cannot occur in a normal fashion. It leaves a thicker portion of cartilage. This cannot receive enough nutrition through diffusion, and it separates from the underlying bone, and then with mechanical strain can fracture off. We have several grades of OCD, 1 through 4, and 1 through 3 are the osteochondrosis grades. And this is a grading from humans. We don't use it really that much in veterinary medicine, but you know, if you Google it or you look it up in textbooks, sometimes these grades will occur. The important thing is, 1 through 3 are OC, and only grade 4 is the one where then we have a fragmentation, so we have an osteochondrosis dissecans, and really only grade 4 is the grade that is symptomatic. If you just have a thicker portion of cartilage, that does not cause any clinical problems, and very likely many of us and many other animals have non-clinical OC. But we just never know about it, because unless we have lameness or pain associated with this, we're probably not getting images of that. Why is it painful when it fragments. There are several factors for that. One is that we now have a mechanical stimulation. We have this flap of cartilage with maybe a little bit of dead bone still attached to it, and just the mechanical rubbing of this loose flap in the bed where it was supposed to be attached will certainly cause some pain. Now, cartilage itself does not have nociceptive fibers. It's not painful. So where we get the pain from is the subchondral bone. The other reason why these dogs then become painful is that the subchondral bone is not supposed to be exposed to joint fluid. It's supposed to be covered by cartilage. And once that flap is loose, we can now get joint fluid to enter the space, and it will cause irritation of the subchondral bone. And then finally, when we discussed how this flap develops, and I will take you one slide back again. So in the separated area of this image here, hang on, right here, when this the deeper layers of cartilage, when they become necrotic and they separate from the subchondral bone, we have dead cartilage cells there. And we also have very, very unhappy subchondral bone. And we develop this pocket of debris and full of inflammatory mediators. So this is a little bit of a trash can in here. This accumulates all the dead cells and everything that we really don't want. And once they start to fragment off, then all this debris will have access into the joint, and that will cause a synovitis. It will cause an inflammation of the joint capsule and also then cause pain. So we have mechanical factors that cause pain. We have factors where the subchondral bone gets stimulated by the joint fluid and it doesn't like that. And then we get synovitis because we now have this debris and this whole slew of inflammatory mediators that get washed through the joint. People always get excited about joint mice. That is an expression for a truly loose flap of cartilage. That certainly can cause a mechanical problem. It can get wedged in the joint space, and it can just, because of its presence, cause pain. But we see this not so often. Most of the time, the OCD flaps are still partially attached to their respective beds, and it's more the local rubbing in that area that then causes a problem. But maybe you've seen cases, and maybe you will see cases where you actually have the loose large fragment that then also contributes to pain. Long term, because of this exposure of bone and this set off of inflammation, set off of synovitis, these dogs very often will develop osteoarthritis. Why do we now get this? Why does this develop? Until we determined, or it was determined, that cartilage does in the early development have blood vessels, we really didn't know about ischemia. Now we know this is a huge, huge component. I mean, this is pretty much it. That's what most people believe. The reason for that, we do not know yet. We believe strongly that it has a hereditary component, and that certainly would make sense to me, because when you look back, it tends to be certain breeds that are affected by this. I think it would be a very easy assumption, and probably a correct assumption, to say, well, you know, if it keeps happening in golden retrievers or Australian shepherds or Great Danes, then there is something in their gene pool that, for whatever reason, makes this one little area in the cartilage develop an ischemia in this time frame of development. So hereditary causes are very high to cause this ischemia. Now, other proposed etiologic factors are trauma. It could be trauma extremely early in the development that then causes a focal ischemia. And certainly later, for an OC to develop into a OCD, you could argue, well, maybe they then did something traumatically and then, you know, ripped this flap off. It is extremely rare to have a truly traumatic cartilage flap develop. And it would be a little bit questionable for me to have trauma always in a pathognomonic area, because OCD develops quite frequently always in the same area that is not a typical area for trauma to occur on the joint surface. So the proposed trauma etiology, I think, just needs to be taken in with caution, and just keep in mind that, yes, it may have happened, the onset of lameness may have happened with a traumatic event, but the processes leading to this were probably already there long before. Another big area of research has been nutrition. It's been proposed that calcium over supplementation, imbalance in phosphorus, can lead to the development of OCD. There are several studies that look at protein intake, and if you have young dogs with lots and lots of protein intake, so very rich feeding and very frequent feeding, that they also had an increased development of OCD. And the thought behind that is that dogs that are very fast growing, that you feed tons to make them grow even more, that the cartilage, the endochondral ossification just cannot keep up. And that may be one reason why you could then have a thicker area of cartilage. Hormonal reasons have also been proposed. So you see, other than that, we now have identified that there's focal ischemia and that there is strong, strong believe that this is hereditary, there are many, many other factors that probably play a role. They may not play a huge role, but they very, very possibly can influence the development. So, because it's believed to be hereditary, keep that in mind when you talk to clients, and especially keep that in mind when you then talk to breeders, because our recommendation in the veterinary community should generally be to not continue breeding dogs that have developed OCD, and also relay this information back to breeders to see if they can maybe switch out the combination in their breeding to hopefully not have this occur again. We can't always blame breeders. There are many, many cases where you really have very responsible breeders and you can still have OCD develop in a puppy. This doesn't reflect bad breeding. We just need to mention this and make sure that people are aware of this. While preparing this talk, I looked through the literature a little bit, and it is interesting. I was still taught a paper on a Great Dane study where Great Dane puppies developed significantly more OCD when they were fed a very high protein diet compared to the Great Dane puppies that didn't receive this. And so there was this big, big, big push, you know, with these dogs that are prone for OCD to definitely not overfeed them. Well, that's generally a good idea because a lot of the developmental diseases tend to occur more when we overfeed these puppies and have them grow even faster. But at the same time, there are now studies that don't really show that relationship. So while I don't think it hurts, and I think it's always a good management and a good educational point for new owners, especially with young puppies, to make sure that they are well educated about proper feeding, we also can't blame the feeding entirely. That's now the entire reason for OCD development. So typical signament for OCD dogs is your 4 to 8 month old young growing large or giant breed dog. Remember, you can diagnose this when they're older, but they will already have developed it when they're younger. The reason that we see them when they're around 4, 5, 6 months old usually is because that's They've developed this thicker area of cartilage, and now they're starting to move, and they're crazy 3-month-old puppies, and this cartilage doesn't just die off. I mean, it takes a little bit of time for this separation to occur between the thicker cartilage and the bone. And then usually by 4, 5, 6 months, they're so to speak, ripe to fragment. And that's then usually when we see them. In the literature, there is a predisposition for male dogs, and that could be related to male dogs growing even larger than female dogs, but in the end, we are not certain about that. And then when the OCD develops, you will see lameness in this affected limb with pain in the joint, and potentially, depending on the chronicity, joint changes. OCD very often occurs bilaterally in the same joint, but also keep in mind that you could have OCD, for example, in both shoulder joints, but it can be concurrently in other joints in the same dog. So a dog could be very unlucky and have it, for example, in both shoulder joints and both tarsal joints. So if you find OCD in one joint, be very, very, very careful in examining the rest of the dog. Typically, after our physical examination and identifying a painful joint, next step is most of the time some form of imaging. And with OCD, radiographs can be extremely helpful, which is great because almost everybody has the ability to take radiographs. Other not so frequently performed but still potentially useful imaging techniques would be ultrasound, CT, and MR. Ultrasound, you would try to identify the separation of cartilage. It really depends on the user and their experience because joint ultrasound is not that easy. So just keep that in mind. It's not, you know, oh, let's just pull out our ultrasound and then here you go. But in some hands, it can be quite a useful test. When we have questionable findings on radiographs or we have other disease that we also want to evaluate, we very often perform CT. It's excellent for bone detail. And sometimes we do MRI. Arthrography, I mentioned this here not because I would like for you to do it, but because you may be exposed to this, you may have seen this in the past. It's injecting a contrast medium into the joint space and then with that hopefully identifying a lesion that affects the cartilage, which you would not see on a radiograph. But because it is quite invasive and it's still not that specific, it has fallen out of favor. With the ability to do CT or MRI, there probably is very little room for doing arthrography. I list arthroscopy under imaging as well because sometimes we use it to diagnose the OCD, but then benefit, of course, is that we can also proceed to treat it via arthroscopy. The therapy depends entirely on the clinical signs. And it depends on the joint status. If you have a dog that has very mild or no osteoarthritic changes versus a dog that already has severe changes in a joint that you may say, well, I don't know if this is salvageable. Some OCD in some joints we will discuss can cause instability, and that certainly also plays a role in your therapy. But overall, you can always consider conservative. Or surgical. And the surgical therapies that we will touch base on are primarily the removal and debridement. And then I will show you some examples where you could consider resurfacing procedures. And also in very rare instances, for certain joints, we can consider arthrodesis as a salvage procedure. Prognosis is extremely variable by location, so which joint is affected, and by chronicity. So what would be the goal of conservative therapy? You have a flap there. The flap will not go away. It will probably stay there for a long, long, long time. So keep that in mind when we pursue conservative therapy, that our expectation is quite low. Sometimes owners really, really, really want to try, and I have no problem with that, but it's perfectly okay to educate them on the fact that the chances are just very slim that this will lead to a long-standing improvement. And with conservative therapy, we mainly try to achieve reduction of our synovitis and inflammation, but we're not fixing the underlying problem. Sometimes I hear that people try to wait to see if the flap will reattach. And in my experience, seeing, you know, the many, many joint changes and the flaps that I have in my career, this is not going to happen in the typical dog. They have dead cartilage on one side and almost dead bone on the other side, with tissue that definitely does not want to heal back together. The only time where I would have any hope for this to be healing conservatively is truly in a 1 or 2 month old puppy, where this endochondral ossification is still absolutely fully ongoing. But apart from that, in your typical dog, you can have virtually no expectation that this flap will grow back into its previous bed. So if I try it, I will try it for a couple of weeks with a very, very guarded prognosis and educate the owner that probably the next step would be surgery. The surgical therapy, the primary goal would be to remove the flap and debride the area so that we get new bleeding, we get the ability to have granulation tissue form, and ultimately have this lesion bed fill with fibrocartilage. And the coverage with fibrocartilage will then cover the subchondral bone and make it happy again, and will stop this constant release of inflammatory mediators into the joint. And of course, with the fibrocartilage, we reestablish some form of joint surface that is more normal than having a big crater of bone exposed into the joint. Of course, the two big questions are always, how is our congruency after we remove the flap? Because there will be a large defect. And you also have to keep in mind that the quality of fibrocartilage is not like the quality of hyaline cartilage, which is super squishy and full of water and is, you know, what our joint is, gives our joint the ability to be shock absorbing, to move around so much. Fibrocartilage is very, very dense. It will be having an irregular surface. So it really can only be considered a coverage and not really a good shock absorber. So keeping these two aspects in mind, we can't expect to just remove the flap and then everything will go back to normal. After the typical removal, I will talk to you about the specific other therapies as we go through the joints. Do consider your analgesia. We very often do give something right at time of surgery, some intra-articular, for example, bupivacaine or lidocaine or morphine. It's okay to give some form of opioid for a couple of days after surgery. You know, there's always the debate on what to give. I'm not going to go into that. Your most effective analgesia will be an NSAID, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, and I typically give those dogs a good couple of weeks or longer, because you do have to keep in mind that they have this exposed bone in their joint. You will create more inflammation in that moment by removing it and debriding it. And if you've ever had a joint injury yourself, you know how long this inflammation can take to go away. So if these dogs after surgery are still lame, they're still sore, then by all means, reevaluate them a couple of weeks after surgery and give them more NSAIDs if that helps them. So absolutely perfectly okay. Post-op therapy otherwise would be exercise restrictions. I typically do that for about 6 weeks and then reevaluate them. And the main idea here is to allow this fibrocartilage to form and not keep re-injuring this area because they're too active. If they require it, I'm a big fan of rehab in any form or shape. So if you can do rehab, then these would be good candidates. And also adjust their diet and adjust their weight if necessary. So now we come to the different joints, and I'm going to try to hit the highlights there. They're quite pathognomonic locations, so they tend to really occur in these specific areas to the point where if you see changes in your radiographs, even radiographically, you can feel comfortable saying, hey, this is an OCD, this is typical location, I'm going to call this, I'm going to diagnose this. We will talk about the four main joints, which are shoulder, elbow, knee, and tarsus. And then I'm going to give you just a little bit of information on the hip and the spine. OCD has been described in other locations as well, but case report wise, and so not something that you're likely to see. Shoulder OCD is the most important of the OCD locations. It is the most common joint. Over 80% of OCD occurs here. And the fantastic thing about this is that it's also the joint with the absolute best prognosis. So very fortunately for dogs, do they get it, they happen to get it in the joint that can tolerate this the best. It is on the caudal humeral head that they develop, and very often they have changes bilaterally. And like we said, usually the large and giant breed dogs, you will very likely also see it in other sporting dogs. And I've seen it a lot in Australian Shepherds. So you may see it in medium-sized dogs, and it tends to be very, very often the same breed of dogs. And maybe you've also had this experience. They're going to be lame in this limb. They're going to be painful on range of motion of the joint. And depending on how long this has been going on, you may also identify muscle atrophy. Radiographically, your money shot is going to be a medial lateral radiograph. So that is the one that you really want to pay very, very good attention to. And if you identify an OCD lesion in the side that was lame and was painful, then you should take a radiograph of the other side to make sure that there is no lesion on the other side. If the other shoulder joint is absolutely, without a doubt, pain-free and zero lameness, no changes, then you do not have to take an X-ray. So we don't just do X-rays bilaterally just because, but if you have any question, if there's any pain in that other shoulder, you're not sure, then I would recommend taking a radiograph. Some things to consider for the radiograph, really try to isolate that shoulder joint, get the other limb out of the way. That's why we recommend a medial lateral radiograph. Make sure that the spine is out of the way, that the neck is up. And some people believe if you can happen to maybe by chance have superimposition of the trachea, it just helps isolate the caudal humeral head a little bit better, as you see in this image. And then we look for flattening or irregularity of the caudal humeral head, like you see here. So flattening of the subchondral bone, irregular surfaces, these are the two typical things that are true for any OCD, right? Other changes that you may see, increased density of the bone. You also see this in this image, that in the area of the irregularity, there is this halo of denser bone. When they're very young, this tends to be edema. And when they're older, that tends to be sclerosis. So just keep in mind that very fresh lesions could be edema, other lesions later on will then have chronic bone remodeling. If it's a lesion that has been present for several weeks, then you may already see bone remodeling, you may see development of osteoarthritis, and you may see a joint mouse in some cases. These radiographs are from a 2-year-old Great Dane that presented for forelimb lameness. And initially, we thought that this dog could be an osseous-associated wobbler. And then we did our exam, found bilateral shoulder pain with quite a lot of muscle atrophy. And we radiographed the dog, and the dog had bilateral shoulder OCD. And it threw people a little bit a loop because you think, well, a 2-year-old dog, why should a 2-year-old dog have OCD? But this dog had OCD since puppyhood and had been lame ever since the dog was 6 months of age and had just not been diagnosed. So this is an example of how you can have very chronic changes that have been there for a long time, but the disease had already developed when the dog was a puppy. Again, in preparation for this dog, I looked through for this talk, I looked through the more recent literature for some things that may be interesting for you. There's one paper that I found helpful, not so much because they found that MRI was more likely than radiograph or ultrasound, because we don't typically do MRI on every OCD case, but they looked at some supinated and pronated views. And I thought this is something that can definitely be reasonably easy to be done. So you just rotate your humeral head into the beam and out of the beam. And in that way, you can make sure that if your OCD is a little bit more to medial or a little bit more to lateral, that you can still catch it tangentially in the nicest plane. So I thought that was quite helpful also for my practice to do that and, you know, maybe not step right up to an MRI. Shoulder OCD therapy, these dogs are outstanding surgical candidates. With surgery, I should have told you that before, with surgery they have the best prognosis. So without surgery they have the same prognosis as every other joint, but with surgery they really have a good to excellent prognosis to return to full function. And the standard surgery would be to do a flap removal and debridement of this area. Because the shoulder has such a large soft tissue envelope, there are so many muscles, this would be one joint that if you can do it yourself or if you feel okay referring this to a specialist that does arthroscopy to do it arthroscopically. It is a beautiful joint to do arthroscopy in. When you look at the open approach and the vessels and nerves that you have to be careful with, and then you look at the limited view that you get because you have to pick, and you know, here you would obviously approach the caudal humeral head. And I mean, this is a approach through about 10 centimeters of tissue to see an area that's maybe half a square centimeter. So it's not easy. It's not terribly hard. I mean, you can do it, but it's definitely a bigger approach. And with arthroscopy, you have minimally invasive approach through the soft tissues with a visibility of almost the entire joint. And that makes arthroscopy for the shoulder really, really attractive. You do need to keep in mind that while arthroscopy is minimally invasive for the approach, we still do the same debridement on the inside. So for the bone surface, it's still maximally invasive. You know, we still create quite a bit of inflammation because we're freshening up this lesion. I just saw a question. Thank you for posing a question. Does subchondral edema, I'm just going to read this out now before we move on. The subchondral edema early look darker around the lesion opposite from sclerosis. You know, that's on radiographs. I've only appreciated it as a more denser looking area. So I've not seen it where it looks less dense, so it would look darker on a radiograph. This is only my experience. I'm not a radiologist, but from the cases that I've seen, I would say it looks brighter. And the reason why I brought up this difference is that you will sometimes be quite impressed by radiographs where you think, my goodness, the caudal humeral head has an OCD, but half of the humeral head really is bright white. It's really, really dense in a very, very young dog. And now that we every once in a while do MRI, we see on MRI that that tends to be edema, and that's why we can make this correlation a little bit better. So thank you for asking this question, and sorry I only saw it now that I didn't answer it right as we were talking about it. So resurfacing procedures, just briefly, this is something that I doubt many people of you are doing, not many specialists actually do it. But it is getting exciting because slowly we have companies that make resurfacing materials, synthetic materials that we can also use in the dog that are of appropriate size for the dog. And for certain lesions, they really are a very, very good alternative for therapy. So when you have a very, very large shoulder OCD, I mean, the humeral head is enormous, and so even a large lesion can often be tolerated by the dog. But if it was just the biggest OCD that you've ever seen on imaging, then that dog may be a candidate for resurfacing. And there are two types of resurfacing. One, we take cartilage and bone from another joint and implant it. Those would be the osteochondral autografts. Or we take a synthetic material and implant it. And what I'm showing you here is a material, it's called Synacard and SpaArthrex. I don't want to make advertisement here, but they're one of the few companies that now produce them for dogs. So I feel that's justified. And you see this here as an example. This was implanted on the caudal humeral head. You see the arthroscopic view, and this gray round area in the middle, that is the synthetic resurfacing material. And it the goal is for these procedures to reestablish a congruent joint surface and therefore then improve function. So back to the prognosis for shoulder OCD, and now for just debridement and removal of the flap. So even if we just do the simplest procedure, this joint has really a very, very good prognosis. And I have yet to see a dog that hasn't come back to good, very good function, or even function where you can't tell that there has ever been a problem. This I always show this picture of this Dane. This was this two-year-old Great Dane that has had OCD for a long, long time. And we removed it, and the owner kept showing this dog and kept winning best in show. And she kept sending me these images. Fortunately, she was a very good owner and breeder, and while she was showing him, she did not continue breeding him. But it just, you know, if a judge on in a dog show can't tell that there is a lameness, then I think these dogs really are well off. Elbow OCD is a different matter. Elbow OCD is one of the OCDs that, pardon my language, sucks. They usually have large area on the medial humeral condyle where they lose this cartilage surface and then have quite a big area of subchondral bone exposed. As you can see on this image, it is right opposite the medial coronoid process. And elbow OCD is one of the components of elbow dysplasia. So keep that in mind. When you find elbow OCD, then look for the other elbow OCD, elbow dysplasia components like a fragmented medial coronoid, FMCP, or ununited anconeal process, or elbow incongruency. And these diseases can occur concurrently. Imaging, your first to go to imaging technique is still radiographs. Now, you know from elbow dysplasia probably that radiographs can be quite tough. You often see arthritis and secondary degenerative changes, but sometimes it can be really difficult to say for sure if there is a coronoid fragment or even if there is an OCD. But still, they're our first line imaging modalities. What can help is, like with the shoulder, if you do oblique views, rotate that medial condyle out a little bit, because that is your typical location of elbow OCD, as you can see on the examples in the images. With the elbow, very often we take the step and do a CT to better evaluate the other areas in the joint and also look for the extent of lesions and the subchondral bone changes. And then we also use arthroscopy to diagnose and evaluate the size of these lesions. OCD, when you if your practice or you see a lot of elbow cases with elbow dysplasia from a fragmented coronoid, these coronoid process patients, they can have incongruency in the elbow joint that then leads to a fragmented coronoid, but it also can lead to abrasion and rubbing off of cartilage on the humeral condyle. And these lesions we call kissing lesions, because they occur because the ulna, the coronoid process, kisses the humeral condyle, so to speak, and then rubs off the cartilage. The image on the right, you can see that down at the bottom here is the fragment of coronoid and the remaining coronoid. You see there is naked bone here, cartilage remnant in the back, and then above is the humeral condyle. We see cartilage on the far side, and then opposite this naked ulnar component, we have also a very large kissing lesion on the humeral condyle. They look on imaging almost identical to an OCD, and OCD would be the example on the left here. You can still see the flap in situ. So clinically, they probably are very similar. Imaging-wise, they also are very similar. It's just that the dog on the left, we remove the flap, debride it, and hope for the best. The dog on the right is in super bad shape because this dog has such severe incongruency that we probably cannot do anything that will improve the joint status at this point if we just do debridement. Therapy for OCD, same thing. We can try conservative or do surgical. Typically, we do surgical with OCD removal and debridement. We can, in severe cases, also consider resurfacing techniques. And for the elbow joint, we have, which is, I guess, also some form of resurfacing, we can do a partial joint replacement or total joint replacement. For the elbow, arthroscopy is also a very attractive method to do your therapy, because you can, you know, see with great magnification, your portals are minimally invasive, but it is also perfectly acceptable for you to do a mini arthrotomy. You just make a very focused small approach to remove and debride the OCD lesion. Prognosis in the elbow is typically guarded to poor. In my experience, when they have large lesions, these dogs will remain lame. That doesn't mean that the overall quality of life for the dog is poor, but owners must just be educated that their dog will very likely have a little bit of a lameness that persists. And that is true for a lot of other components of elbow dysplasia, as you know. Stifle OCD is quite similar to the elbow. Elbow and stifle are joints that they're quite large, but they're very restrained. And if you have OCD lesions on the main weight-bearing articular surfaces in a constrained joint, then the dog can't do anything else but put weight on this lesion. We think that that is one of the reasons why OCD in the shoulder is tolerated so well, because it's a very loose joint and non-constrained, and dogs can position this joint in a way that takes pressure off the OCD. So stifle OCD example in this image here, you can see this is the lateral femoral condyle, quite a large defect right smack in the middle of that condyle. We see a beautiful craniocruciate ligament coming out just above this retractor. Caudal cruciate is here. So you see, this is a pretty decent sized lesion that certainly will give this dog lameness, osteoarthritis, and pain on manipulation. Stifle OCD cases are very, very, very frequently mistaken for cruciate ligament cases. And because on your examination you would find a stable joint, it gets even trickier, because now we know that dogs can be quite lame from a partial cruciate tear. And I have myself made this wrong diagnosis and said, oh, this dog must have a partial tear. Let's do, you know, let's explore, let's look. And then it wasn't a partial cruciate tear, but it was an OCD. So if you have a stable stifle joint, but you have significant osteoarthritis, so osteophytes, periarticular new bone formation in other areas, very thick stifle through fibrosis, but it's entirely stable, youngish dog, then please, please, please keep an OCD of the stifle on your list. And like with what we said before, this OCD has been present ever since the dog was young, but we may not have picked up on it until now. Radiographs, again, our first diagnostic tool, and we look for flattening irregularity of the condyle, like we see in this area here. We also see it in this area right over here. The craniocaudal view can be a little bit tougher. We have naturally some areas that look like there could be a circular lesion, like on the lateral condyle here. But this particular dog had an OCD lesion on the medial condyle. So scrutinize these condyles, and if you're not sure, take a radiograph that you already have taken from another dog and compare it, because some of these lines on the craniocaudal stifle view can be very misleading. But hopefully you'll see it on the lateral views as flattening of the condyles. Same thing here. We usually do surgical therapy with OCD removal and debridement. You can see it in this image here. We've done an arthrotomy and are debriding with a curette. You can also do this arthroscopically, of course. The stifle tends to be one of the joints that many people feel comfortable opening. And I certainly have no issue with you doing an arthrotomy to debride this. The bone can be quite hard, and I've also struggled with doing this debridement arthroscopically and had to convert some patients to an arthrotomy after arthroscopy. So definitely one joint where you shouldn't feel bad if you do it yourself through an arthrotomy. The stifle is the most attractive joint to do an osteochondral autograft. So where we take cartilage and bone from another area and transplant it to resurface this. The reason why the stifle is so attractive is that we steal the cartilage and bone from the stifle. So we go into the same joint, as you can see on the image on the right, and from the lateral and medial aspect of the femoral condyles, we can obtain these grafts. And it's a plug where you have cartilage and bone that you then transplant. The bone part is important because that is what grows back into the femur, not the cartilage. The cartilage will just resurface. The bone is what holds it in place. You can also see that this is not innocuous. This is quite invasive. And we tend to hesitate at going into the stifle as a donor joint and creating such huge lesions to help another joint in the same dog. And this is why these synthetic products that are slowly, slowly becoming available are so attractive, because we don't have to go into a healthy joint and cause a lot of damage there to help another joint. But if it's already in the stifle, then we don't feel quite so bad stealing it from the same joint and putting it in to cover a weight-bearing surface. Okay, when debriding, is it obvious when we're taking enough bone into the depth? Thank you for another question. You will debride generally until you see a little bit of subchondral bleeding. if you can do it arthroscopically, it's really nice when the joint is full of fluid, because then you see the blood really going into the lavage fluid. You can see these little blood worms coming out of the subchondral bone. When you do it open, it can be a little bit harder. But once you get through that first layer of very sclerotic subchondral bone, you usually get into a little bit of softer bone, then you stop. And what I would do, if you can't distinguish these two layers, then debride a little bit, you know, half a millimeter, millimeter, do some lavage and see if with a naked eye you can identify that there is some bleeding coming. We try not to debride too aggressively, because we have to keep in mind that everything that we debride is lost, right? There's not going to be new bone forming in this crater. So we really just want to take the very top layer off, and if it already feels like it's quite soft and, ooh, there's bleeding coming out, well, then we stop. We don't have to debride lots. If it's a polished, completely marble hard surface, then you do want to debride a little bit more. And sometimes on the really, 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 really hard surfaces, I even take a very small K-wire or small drill and make micro perforations instead of debriding everything to a greater depth. I make perforation holes in the hope that then through those we can have new blood vessels coming into our lesion. Thank you very much for another very good and clinical question. So here's the synthetic joint resurfacing. We talked about this already. I'm going to skip forward. Stifel prognosis is similar to the elbow in that it is, in my experience, guarded and sometimes poor for the joint. The dog may tolerate it. The dog may have a very good quality of life, but please, please be sure to warn owners that with OCD of the elbow and Stifel, it is very likely that some degree of lameness persists. Tarsal OCD is the second most common joint, and it's the worst joint. It's a very, very tight joint, and when we have this OCD develop, it usually develops on one of the talar ridges, usually the medial. And when you just picture a radiograph, picture the anatomy of the talocrural joint, this is super tight. And if you lose that talar ridge on one side and you just have this flap, rubbing and grinding in there, and then you take it out, you really cause instability, and these dogs don't do very well in that joint. So they will often come to you with quite a severe lameness and already quite a thickened and scarred joint that is very chronically changed already. Same thing here. We first try to get a diagnosis with radiographs, and there are special radiographic views that you can consider, skyline views to get the calcaneus out of the way to really see the talar ridges better. When you look at this image on the right, I mean, you can really, once you do this position here, these skyline views, you can really see the lateral and medial talar ridge quite nicely. And what we're looking for are lesions that take off these tips of these two ridges here, so either lateral or medial. On this image, you can see there is a defect right in this area, same here. So they can be a little bit tougher to see on radiographs. And if you have a suspicion, then do take the time, look up your special views, see if you can do some oblique views and to get a better impression of these talar ridges. And if that fails, then CT would be a very good alternative, advanced imaging. This is an image of CT. You see this is in the mid portion of the talar ridge on the medial side, and you see the flap still in position, and these joints are just not tolerant for these types of lesions. They will very, very quickly form severe arthritis and have chronic degenerative changes, and then the joint overall is just not in good shape. So surgical removal, we do consider that, and the younger the dogs are, the more minimal the radiographic changes are in the joint from secondary changes, the more I would be really, really happy to go in and remove it, because then I have the hope that maybe we can keep the development of arthritis at bay. But oftentimes when they come in and they have severe arthritis, they have severe changes, many, many people will question whether just removing the OCD will make any difference. And that has also been my experience. Then it's the pebble in the shoe. But if the whole shoe is completely destroyed, you know, if the whole foot is now kaput, then taking the pebble out of the shoe is probably not going to fix the clinical signs. In the tarsus, we often do a mini arthrotomy, even experienced arthroscopists, because the tarsus is quite tight. It is possible to do it arthroscopically, but most of the time we would do it with a mini arthrotomy. In the tarsus, because it is such a bad joint to have this in, a resurfacing would be quite attractive, but the shape of the joint makes it very, very tough. You know, you can't just go into the stifle and take a flat piece of cartilage and then put this in instead of a talar ridge. What is now described a little bit is that people take whole chunks of talus from a dead dog of similar size and then implant that as an allograft. So, you know, people are trying to be creative with treatment for these things, but the most common one would still be take it out, see what happens. For the tarsus itself, one other option if the prognosis really is poor because of the secondary changes will be to do pantarsal arthrodesis. And so while the tarsus kind of has the worst prognosis, it really is not that bad, because at least we have one option to treat a painful joint with a procedure that then hopefully takes the pain away and gives them, you know, still keeps a good function. So that is one thing to consider for a very, very bad tarsal OCD, that if you can't treat this conservatively anymore, to pursue a carpal pantarsal arthrodesis. Very quickly, hip. It's usually on the femoral head. Treatment would be either an FHO or total hip replacement, or pursue conservative therapy. And then on the vertebra, it happens very, very frequently on the sacrum, as you can see on this radiograph. There is an OCD of the end plate, so they occur on the vertebral end plates. And then, again, these are young, young, young dogs, large breed dogs, and they can look very similar to cauda equina, with lumbosacral pain, maybe lameness down the limb, maybe even some neurologic deficits. And treatment very often is conservative, because it's quite tough to actually get to this area or to simply do a dorsal decompression. So with this, we are at the end. Thank you so much for bearing with me. In summary, we have OCD being a focal disorder of our endochondral ossification. And we've determined that this very, very likely the primary cause for that is an ischemia, a focal ischemia. But the reason for this ischemia, we don't know yet. We do know that there is evidence that it's hereditary, so keep that in mind when talking to breeders, that just a thickened cartilage would be an osteochondrosis, and once that thicker area fissures and separates, it would be an osteochondrosis dissecans. Therapy is usually surgically with debridement and removal of the flap. And for some joints, it would be really, really awesome if it could be done minimally invasively via arthroscopy. For other joints, be totally fine to open them up. And the prognosis really varies, with the shoulder being the absolute best to have it in. I always go, yay! I love shoulder arthroscopy, so I love shoulder OCD. And for other joints, being much more guarded or poor. And if you have another couple of minutes, you can think of some questions, and I have a video that we can look at. This is a dog with shoulder OCD treated by arthroscopy. Thank you for the comment. Can everybody see this video? I hope so. So this is the biceps tendon in the cranial aspect of the joint. So you see with arthroscopy, we can really take a look around the entire joint. At the bottom is our humeral head. Above, you can just make out the glenoid fossa. And the structures that you're seeing in the very back, that's the medial collateral ligament. And here, wham, there is our OCD lesion. You see in the cranial aspect, it's detached, and caudally, it's still attached. And that's very, very common for these OCD lesions. They're like a garbage can lid. They're still attached on one side. Here, we're going all the way to the caudal pouch to make sure that there wasn't a loose fragment. And now we're putting an instrument portal in. We're grabbing these flaps. I've learned to break them apart because I can't expect for a 1 centimeter lesion to come out of a 2 millimeter scope portal. yeah, you learn that as you do arthroscopy. We're loosening the flap a little bit and then breaking it up in more pieces and just taking it out piecemeal. You see, this is completely detached. It's like a piece of rubber. And when you look at that, there is just no way that that piece would ever, ever, ever grow back to the mother bone. The subchondral bone there is completely sclerosed off. It's unhappy. It's not had anything attached to it. It's very hard. It's not bleeding. So there's no incentive for that bone to somehow heal back that cartilage flap. Back to the question, when do you know how deep to debride? You just saw the bleeding blood vessels really come through. And even here, you can see we're getting to the edge and you already start to see bleeding. So when we get to that part, the cartilage is nice and thin and we have bleeding from the subchondral bone. At that point, I stop the debridement. And then the last step would be you lavage the joint really well to get out of get all the bone debris out because that can be quite inflammatory as well. And then you're done. And you absolutely can do this with an open approach. I don't want you to think that you can't do that if you feel comfortable with that, with them. Just for some joints, arthroscopy really lends itself as a therapeutic tool. So with that, thank you so much, and thank you for questions. This was really great, and then I wish you a very good rest of the day and look forward to speaking to you the next time. Thank you so much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Bianca for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.